Hi, welcome to Understory, Western Australia's only environment program. This 27th day of March, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Poe, and in the background, you can hear the irrepressible Sharni Graham.
Yes, now!
Speaking at last Saturday night's Hilton Harvest Twilight Fair and Earth Hour celebration.
In fact, I do believe, looking at my watch, that it's about 10 seconds to Earth Hour. So, are you ready?
Nine.
Hang on, no. I get the microphone, therefore I'm the boss. Are you ready? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Look at that. You thought some of the lights were going to be on still.
There was a scarecrow competition, cargo bike rides, a permaculture stall, craft activities and stargazing in the dark, which is part of the Earth Hour experience. The setting was significant, the Hilton Harvest Community Garden, a place where people can grow food. You might be surprised that in WA there are community gardens from Lockridge to Leaderville, from Hilton to Como, Bunbury to Manjimup. But they're about much more than just growing food. Soon on Understory, Adrienne Glamorgan speaks to Janet Parker from the Hilton Harvest Mob about community gardens and their role in the bigger story of ecological and socially inclusive sustainability. We can share an even bigger story first. Food shortages. Last year, the United Nations warned of a worldwide food crisis caused by global grain reserves hitting rock bottom, unreliable climate, and rising food prices. So how did all this happen?
Australia, which has always been at the end of the world, so far as trade and geopolitics is concerned, now has a foregrounded relevance in a revitalised Asian century. After all, unlike most countries, we are a net food exporter. There will be 10 billion people to feed around the world sometime between 2040 and 2080, and Australia will find a way of making a return. The reason is food matters. We need it individually to survive, and we need food as a community to stay together. The Arab Spring began with food riots. In fact, food prices predicted the Arab Spring. Mohamed Bouazizi self-immolated in Tunisia, and food riots turned into a wider campaign for democracy in North Africa and the Middle East. Hungry people riot. Once dictators can no longer guarantee subsidised food prices, their people have nothing to lose. Syria went untouched by the Arab Spring until food prices shot up. In Britain, food prices have increased by a third since 2007. The World Development Movement has warned that the era of cheap food is definitely over. If so, that food index threshold and the issue of food security is going to matter much more to social planners, the military and governments than commonly realised. And it's going to have real economic effects. And it's going to have real environmental effects.
The World Food Summit in 1996 defined food security as existing when all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, nutritious food to maintain a healthy and active life. Food security is built on food availability, food access, being able to farm or pay for the food, and food use, an understanding of nutrition and sanitation.
While the increasing consumption of prestige processed food increases costs to world consumers directly and through lifestyle diseases such as diabetes, today I just want to touch on food availability and food access. Firstly, climate change is affecting food availability. UK Chief Scientist Professor Sir John Beddington said in January 2013 that world agriculture was being affected by major changes in weather patterns, leading to food supplies being extremely fragile. Weather patterns shift. Storms are more severe, seasons are being disrupted, and they affect insects and their predators. And rain just doesn't come, or does when it shouldn't. This change to climate is having a big impact on crops. Droughts in various rice bowls has led to a 10 to 20% loss in rice yields over the last 10 years, with impact from North Africa through the Middle East to the Indian subcontinent. In 2012, 80% of the US was subject to heat waves damaging yields across the country. Recently, Eastern Europe felt the sharp scythe of a heat wave and crops failed. World production in crops by 2050 could fall by a predicted 20 to 40%. In a market already made volatile by climate change, there is more to come. Desertification is cutting access to arable land. But there's another way food access is being sorely affected. Speculators. As Bertolt Brecht said once, famines don't just happen, they're caused by the grain trade. Now, to explain. For more than a century, some farmers have sold their food crops well in advance. They attract a guaranteed price, it gives them some kind of certainty, and they get finance to get the seed sown. When the crop is finally harvested, the farmer receives the long-promised price, not whatever the actual harvest price is all around them. It suited parts of agriculture and the food industry to do this. But some traders started to sell their contracts to people with no connection to agriculture or the food industry. The futures market was born. Financial traders played with spot prices, pushing up food prices for short-term gains. The World Development Movement says that speculators holding contracts in basic food staples such as wheat or rice have grown from 12% of the market in 1996 to 61% now. These speculators gamble on outcomes. They play derivatives. They make millions of dollars in profits. They dominate the food trade right now.
When staple food prices shot up through this kind of speculation in 2007-2008, millions more went to sleep each night with an ache in their belly. The World Development Movement called gambling on hunger in financial markets dangerous, immoral, and indefensible.
But an induced food crisis has proved to be highly profitable. With software now that can buy and sell within microseconds, the futures market is a game tragically played at the poor's expense. If people go hungry, well, collateral damage. If anything, it guarantees the price will go even higher. And should a commodity return to a lower wholesale price, supermarket prices rarely reflect this. Food speculation ratchets up the base retail price. So food availability is being reduced through climate change, and food access to land or money, is being reduced through an unregulated international speculation that's causing higher prices. 61% of the futures market being traded by these speculators. It's no surprise that countries throughout East and South Asia, but especially China, are becoming increasingly interested in avoiding social turmoil like the Arab Spring that came out of the food riots. Food security is becoming a long-term focus of governments. While they seek to secure their long-term food resources, Australian governments sense an economic opportunity. For where better to suggest to these near neighbours than Northern Australia?
The 5th Northern Australia Ministerial Forum at Kununurra last November agreed that the development of agriculture in Northern Australia is a rapidly emerging policy priority across the north, supporting the national and international food security and regional development more broadly.
Perhaps it's a sign of the times that the winner of the Canberra Centenary Design Competition, imagining how an Australian national capital might look if created today, located a new northern capital situated on the shores of Lake Argyle here in Western Australia. Open up the north. Sell expanses of land to foreign investors. Make them pay, surprisingly willingly, for the infrastructure costs. Dam it. Irrigate it, spray it, grow vast monocultures, develop GM varieties. The North is a big place, Asia's new food bowl. Now, exhilaration levels are high. The next Northern Australia Ministerial Forum will be in Cairns, also to host a high-level delegation of Chinese provincial ministers, inspired by a report entitled
Feeding the Future, a joint Australia-China report on strengthening investment and technological cooperation in agriculture to enhance food security.
Yet, a few are asking about where we fit into this bold new world. Increasingly, there are concerns about our food sovereignty and the environmental consequences of northern development. The North evokes grand visions, big ideas, but notable failures too. Our naive larrikinism is endearing to so many abroad, but it is also an innocence easily abused. Technocrats like Beddington rush in to say genetically modified food is the answer. Countries like China look to Northern Australia and propose their own Asian food bowl. Political leaders say we will make money. But there is little attention being paid to the fact that selling the productivity of our farms to other countries will deprive us of that security ourselves. We cannot eat money. And there is little attention to what damming rivers, irrigating fields, introducing GM foods and terraforming northern landscapes will do to our environment. In 1788, the English at Sydney Cove almost starved. The first crop was foolishly planted that summer and failed to germinate, the seeds overheated from the long journey out. They failed to understand. Only a tight dictatorship by Governor Arthur Phillip helped save this settlement from starvation. That year in France, a July hailstorm destroyed crops. Across the country, leaving the worst harvest in almost half a century. The foolish few in the palace danced with the little money that was left. 1789 brought riots, social unrest, and revolution. And then the tumbrils and the guillotine came. So, Australia, once at the end of the world, now incredibly relevant to a revitalised Asian century. 10 billion people to feed. But what will happen to our food sovereignty?
That was Adrienne Glamorgan with Anna Poe giving Understory listeners the global picture around food security. What can any of us do in the face of this uncertainty? A solid practical step forward is growing our own food. If not in our own backyard, then in a shared community garden. There are a surprising number in WA. Just go on the internet site, communitygardenswa.org.au, to find out your closest. At Saturday's fair, things got quiet on the Earth Hour, and Adrian took advantage of the brief lull in entertainment to ask Janet about the Hilton Harvest Community Garden.
Well, I'm Janet Parker, and I work in the disability sector. And I'm also on the committee of Hilton Harvest Community Gardens. I became involved in a sort of significant way in Hilton Harvest recently, having helped them apply for a grant that was made available through Disability Services Commission for community organisations to work toward social inclusion. And the grant has actually been formally applied for through Fremantle Council, who are the administrators of the grant. It has enabled us to employ a project officer one day a week, and with the team already involved in the Hilton Community Gardens, we are seeking to ensure that the garden is inclusive of all sectors of the local community. I mean, the thing about Hilton, the thing that's unique about, well, that's great about Hilton and that makes it really a wonderful suburb is that it's got incredible diversity. We've got quite a number of migrants who have come into Hilton. We've got some older folk who came here as part of the soldier settlement plan. We've got quite a significant Aboriginal population. We have a lot of, what else? I think, and in fact, I happen to know, and I think it's a bit of a hidden thing, but in fact, we have a lot of people with disabilities living both in homes coordinated by non-government organisations, but also by the Disability Services Commission in this arena. And it struck me the other day when we were down here doing a busy bee, and we've been advertising the fact that we want to include, you know, greater sections of the community. We had somebody come down from one of the local aged care facilities. Somebody who's been a gardener all her life said she was finding it terribly difficult to be in the confines of a home without a garden anymore. She'd gardened all her life. It had been her big passion. And we talked to her about whether she'd be interested in being a mentor for newer, younger, or other folk who've never before gardened. And her eyes just lit up, and it was just clearly something that she thought she would absolutely love to do. And she said, oh, I'm no expert. But I mean, that's just the point. We're not interested in experts. I guess we're interested in sharing just the day-to-day knowledge that people pick up along the way and imparting that to as many people as we can. The Education Department has actually made a portion of their oval available for us to use. It's a good relationship to have with the school because the school are also involved, and tonight at our Twilight Fair we actually had two stalls from Hilton Primary School, and the idea is that over time the school will become more involved in the gardens and will play a role in looking after the chooks and maybe be part of our recycling programs and growing veggie programs. And ideally what we'd love to see one day is a harvest and cooking program that the school kids can participate in as well. We've been going for a few years and it has been slow progress, but we've got 26 beds at the moment. Some are community beds that can be gardened by all, and others are beds that are actually leased by individuals and or families. And sometimes people will just garden for a year and then they might move on and other people will pick up those beds. What we're aiming to do, we don't want it to be a sort of a small, closed affair. The idea that somehow, you know, we've all the beds are taken up and other people, there's no room for anyone else to come in, is a concern. Part of the social inclusion grant that we've applied for is going to involve developing a partnership with the Men's Shed, who have agreed to have some of their carpenters, who many of whom used to teach at technical colleges and TAFEs, to have them come along and run workshops on showing people how to build their own vegetable beds. And through that process we're going to ask them to help us build raised vegetable beds for people who have mobility problems. So that might be older folk, it might be people who use wheelchairs. We also want to get some pathways in so that people who use wheelchairs and older folk who do have, you know, difficulty on the very rough turf that we have here at the moment will be better able to participate. We're going to develop a sensory garden and a performance space. And we have a partnership with an organisation called Sensorium, who are a local group who live in and around Hilton, Hamilton Hill, who have been over to the UK and worked with the foremost people involved in developing sensory theatre for children with profound and complex disability. And they have developed a number of programs, but their primary one being a play called The Jub Jub Tree, which is very sensory in the way that it's performed. It's so for children who are blind or deafblind or who can't readily access the sort of theatre that we see through our traditional sources like Spare Puppet and so on. Really what we want to do is seek to make sure that everything we do is involving and engaging of everybody.
It sounds very much like an exciting intersection between environment, backyard agriculture, community building, skills empowerment, networking, and social inclusion. Would you say this is a strong picture of sustainability in the city that we should be trying to find to do in different ways in different places all across Perth?
I believe so. It does bind community in a way that I think is quite significant. Increasingly, I have this sense, particularly where you walk through a suburb where everybody has their double garage that takes up almost the entire frontage of their property, and they go through their double garage and into an internal door into their home, there's a chance that you would never have any relationship with people living around you. And this is really to try and bring people out of their houses and into a spot that where people can congregate and be part of their community and be contributing. And also, I guess, there is the ecological message that we want to be sort of understood loud and clear too, is that, you know, we really, as a community, we need to be not just know and understand the issues of global warming and climate change, but to a great extent, we need to be a part of trying to bring about change and prevent that whole problem from deepening. Now, that's not going to happen by one community garden, you know, a handful of people growing their own vegetables. Obviously, that's a kind of a fantasy, but it's part of a broader movement, I guess. So we have film nights here during the summer months down on the Oval, and we'll be running workshops and educational workshops. And even when we get together here for our busy bees, somebody usually prepares a little workshop on, you know, mulching or on using bentonite clay to improve soil water retention or on organic pest control. So it's a slow process of education and involvement, and it does touch on lots of issues and lots of fronts, I guess. Many of us don't actually have a plot here, and some people have thought that's a bit odd. In fact, I was talking to a guy the other day who came by and said, I'd like to join, but, you know, I've got my own garden at home that I'm really quite busy with, but I really like the other aspects of what the community gardens is seeking to achieve. And I think for me too, I'm quite obsessive about my garden at home as well, but I think what this generates for people is that sense of people working together and achieving together.
Well, across Perth from places like West Leederville, Hilton, Lockridge, there are these community gardens. But if people live in a neighbourhood where there isn't a community garden, what can they do about getting in touch with people who know about this sort of thing?
They're very welcome to look at our website, and certainly finding a venue is possibly the first and most difficult thing to do. So getting a group of people together, I guess, who are interested, and going to council and having a yarn with them about possible opportunities is probably a good starting point. There's also, of course, people in Hubble Street down in South Frio who have a very amazing initiative going on down there. I think that people should probably make contact with their local council, look at their website, because often there will be a link to any initiatives around the development of community gardens in their area.
Adrienne Glamorgan speaking with Janet Parker about growing our own veggies with a community at a neighbourhood location.
Yeah.
And before then, Adrienne and Anna Poe provided the context for growing food security issues that is already affecting Northern Australia. I'm Elizabeth Poe, and that's all the time we have for Understory this week. You can hear this program again, or earlier shows, by going onto the RTR FM website. Otherwise, we look forward to hearing you next week, same time on Morning Mag, when yet again there'll be more to explore on Understory. Mm-hmm.